This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
All right, my lovelies, it is time for the fifth episode of Liner Note Leftovers. I hope you're all very, very comfy. You're wearing your best battle jacket and you've eaten your brain food. I know I have. A couple of bar olives and a can of Rolling Rock from two Christmases ago. The Lemmy Kilmeister breakfast. And speaking of which, we got a whole lot to talk about today. Got a little Reefer Madness to tell you about. And speaking of madness, we're talking about how some upside down flags almost led to Rage Against the Machine getting arrested by the Secret Service. And maybe, if that doesn't tickle your fancy, how about a little bit of Sesame Street lore? I know, how do all these ideas connect? Well, you're just gonna have to buckle in and listen to another episode of Liner Note Leftovers. Let's get ready, my lovelies, to go crate digging once again. I never thought we would be talking about Sesame Street trivia, but here we are. But it is important because on April 12th, 1973, that the legendary Stevie Wonder made the biggest guest star appearance for a musician in Sesame Street history. Now, he wasn't the first. I don't want anyone to get it twisted now. Pete Seeger had appeared a bunch of times. Don McLean had been on an episode in season one, right after he was starting to get big with the American Pie single. Oh, that's got to be a depressing episode of Sesame Street. Snuffleupagus takes his Chevy to the levee, drinking whiskey with rye. I'm embellishing, of course. But Stevie Wonder was the biggest musical act to appear on the show by far by then. I mean, he was one of the biggest acts in the world in 1973. So he gets on there, he has some cute moments teaching Grover how to sing, plays a 7-minute long live version of Superstition, which is over 10% of the runtime of the show. It's completely unheard of, but they did it on Sesame Street. Hey, he even adapted some of the lyrics to talk about Cookie Monster. But you gotta think, it's gotta be tough to play an extended version of a song you wrote, changing the lyric on a show with a bunch of puppets and children running around. Well, according to Stevie Wonder bass player Scott Edwards, they were so zoned in that they weren't paying attention to the kids, and they weren't paying attention to the puppets. Which again, I still find bizarre. There's a 7-foot bird walking around. How are you not paying attention? But this episode with Stevie Wonder ended up being so powerful. And in fact, Sonia Manzano, who you know played Maria, said everybody in the studio, white people, black people, young people, old people, they were all rocking together listening to Stevie Wonder, that it really showed the original goal of Sesame Street to teach kids not only about the fundamentals of learning, reading, writing, English, all that kind of stuff, but also how to be better people, how to be kind each other, how to coexist with each other, how to be inclusive, that kind of thing. This was a catalyst moment for that, according to her, and according to a lot of people. And from there, that inspired so many more famous acts to get on the show. I'm talking about Johnny Cash, I'm talking about Paul Simon, I'm talking about Billy Joel. Nowadays, we got major acts like Katy Perry and Ice-T showing up on the show, and I bet you never thought you'd think that before. But that's the power on the street, man. However, some people have had to follow Wonder's example and adapt their music a little bit, mostly James Blunt for changing You're Beautiful into a triangle as the song. But if you know what those lyrics are about, you'll know it's good that it was changed for children's TV. But that's neither here nor there. Credited for being one of many factors to launch Sesame Street into the stratosphere, the next level, Stevie Wonder, Superstition.
Live from the Sesame Street.
Very superstitious.
Rage Against the Machine, April 13th, 1996, joined an illustrious crowd of people who have been banned from SNL. And the stories are wilder and wilder depending on who you're talking about. I mean, you got Fear, the legendary punk band, starting a riot that smashed up the set. Sinead O'Connor ripping up that picture of the Pope. And of course, who could forget legendary Mr. Television, Milton Berle, whipping out his junk at people, carrying on like a maniac. That's a true story, by the way. He's not the wholesome family crooner you thought he was. But perhaps one of the most famous incidents is, of course, Rage Against the Machine getting kicked off SNL for the sheer aggressive nature of how it was done. First off, I want it on record that this was a disaster waiting to happen because the host of the show was going to be Steve Forbes. That's right, Steve Forbes, billionaire, ex-presidential candidate, family values conservative, you know, a bad mix for the blatantly left-leaning, almost communist political revolutionaries that were Rage Against the Machine. Now, Rage Against the Machine had already planned to do a sort of protest on the show, either which way, but things were getting even more to a head as they had to sit there and endure Steve Forbes trying to be part of SNL skits and somehow throw in promoting his flat tax plan. So the band shows up at rehearsals with American flags that they're going to put upside down, which is a Navy sign that a boat is in distress. And the rehearsal crew says, no, guys, come on, you can't have these up. Take them down. They get in about a 10-minute back and forth argument before they finally say, all right, we'll take the flags down. Saturday dress rehearsal goes off without a hitch. But as we know, things all change when they begin their set and play Bulls on Parade. Because amazingly, the flags somehow ended up back up. After they finished the song, it's been alleged that Lorne Michaels literally ran them out of the studio. They were thrown out with no cozy goodnight wave at the end, no hugging anybody. They just gotta leave. Except for Tim Comerford, who ripped up that American flag and threw it at Steve Forbes' entourage. And immediately gets mobbed by the Secret Service. Because if you don't know, Secret Service, they protect presidential candidates as well too. So they think that this crazy dude from Rage Against the Machine is coming to attack the guy who wants to be president. Now later, Rage Against the Machine and the existing cast of Saturday Night Live smooth things over with the band saying, yeah, we get it. These guys just want to keep their jobs. We're not going to try and take that from them. But, and this is the final note on this one, Rage Against the Machine says if they thought that was bad, just think about the other stuff that they were planning to do in that 8-minute set. Whew, one can only imagine. Weapons, not food, not home, not shoot, not need, just be the war, cannibal, animal. All right, for this one, we kind of got to set the stage just a little bit. In 1980, things were not looking great in the heavy metal community. We had just lost Bon Scott. AC/DC looks like it might not have gone on. John Bonzo Bonham was gone.
Things did not look good for Sabbath either.
And Judas Priest was still being compared to bands like Kiss and Van Halen. I know, they seem radically different, but that's what was perceived before the fourth album dropped
April 14th, 1980,
41 years ago, British Steel. And think about that, British Steel, just a hard, heavy metal name. You know what you're getting into when you buy this album. The name takes inspiration from the English Midlands that all of the members of the band grew up in, because it was a steelworking town, which Judas Priest guitarist Glenn Tipton says that they did grow up in a labyrinth of heavy British steel. And this was the first Judas Priest album to really take off in America, no doubt helped along by the fact that it cost about $2 to buy at the record store in 1980, which even at that time was still a huge, huge discount. It went gold and it's credited as ushering in a completely new era of heavy metal. And that's pretty great considering that this thing was made in a 28-day frenzy as Priest was getting ready to do another tour. There were no breaks, no days off, and I mean no days off. I'm talking about Glenn Tipton coming up with guitar chords at 4 in the morning when Rob Halford was trying to sleep. And instead of toning it down as requested, Tipton would ask Halford, hey, what kind of lyrics would you put to this? And then they just start and write music. Middle of the night, loud guitars, those iconic vocals, hefty drums. And I haven't even gotten into the smashed light bulbs, destroyed billiard cues, and other such destruction that they did to get the sound on songs like Breaking the Law and Metal Gods. Despite this, the whole album does have sort of a off-the-cuff, live sort of feel. That's what happens when you're under the gun and have 3 weeks to record an album. But fans responded to this. On their next tour, they started playing songs like Grindr and Living After Midnight, which caught the ears of a whole bunch of metal fans. And of course, the electrifying stage show as well, too. You can't go wrong with that. I mean, Rob Halford literally shooting a machine gun on stage. It was full of blanks, the fire marshal checked, and watched him load the gun, because they didn't want these crazy rockers to be doing anything too stupid. And the rest is, how you say, history. Judas Priest, British Steel ushers in a whole new era of rock and roll.
And man, are we thankful for it.
So interesting to think that smoking a little smoke was this huge taboo thing that you could never talk about in music, when nowadays we got whole songs about recreationally drinking cough syrup, but that is once how it once was.
It was on April 15th, 1971, Rolling Stone breaks.
The Illinois Crime Commission has put out a list of 8 super offending songs that'll brainwash your kids to get into drugs. And granted, there are some obvious drug tracks on this list, including the classic White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane. But honestly, who would have thunk it? The person who tried to spike LSD into Richard Nixon's coffee was writing songs about drugs. Amazing. The Beatles' Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was on the list, and John Lennon has said that's not about drugs, but come on, come on. But what was really weird is songs like Puff the Magic Dragon, the kids' song by Peter, Paul, and Mary nowadays, and the Beatles, With a Little Help from My Friends, was on the list. Which, even though it does have the line, I get high with a little help from my friends, that song is not about drugs. It's about camaraderie with your friends. That just happens to be an activity you can take part in with your friends. That rumor even got so prevalent, though, that the current vice president, Spiro Agnew, was spouting off about it. But the funniest one is Puff the Magic Dragon, which is not about marijuana, but is actually about a poem written in 1959, which was about the loss of childhood innocence. But try telling that to anybody when the war on drugs is just beginning and you got a narrative to tell everybody about. And here's the thing. While being on the infamous 8 list couldn't really hurt these tracks in terms of getting anybody in the band arrested, couldn't really use it as evidence, the FCC was super duper sly about this and put out a notice reminding radio stations that, hey, this is what these songs are about. They didn't say take them off, because that would be censorship under the First Amendment. But this is what those songs are about. And a lot of them got dropped. Now, granted, for a couple of weeks, until audience outcry ended up bringing it all back, but crazy to think, the most offensive song of the day was once Puff the Magic Dragon and With a Little Help from My Friends.
Outstanding.
What do I do when my love is away? Does it worry you to be alone? How do I feel by the end of the day? Are you sad because you're on your own? I get by with a little help from my friends. Get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help.
Anyone who's in a band knows that there are good shows and there are bad shows, the perils of working in front of a live microphone. But do most bands have shows that are so bad they contribute to the breakup of the band, at least for the first time? Well, in this context it is. We are talking about Electric Light Orchestra, who played their first show at the Greyhound Pub
April 16th
in 1972. And the one thing you gotta understand about ELO at the time is they were trying to be something radically different. They were trying to pick up where the Beatles' psychedelic phase was and just run with it. And this was no small task. When the first incarnation of ELO came out, they had violin players, cello cello players, string bass players, horn players, woodwinds. They were trying to merge the pop and rock sound of the day with classical music to create this psycho sound. And they hadn't played a ton of shows by the time their first album was out because of how logistically heavy it was to put on a show. But they decided, hey, we're gonna do this. And we're gonna do it at the Greyhound because this place has seen the likes of Hendrix, The Who, David Bowie, Queen. If you made it at the Greyhound, you made it, at least according to their owners. ELO? They did not make it at the Greyhound, though. Despite being something new and wild and even going so far as to guys playing with orange and grapefruit peels to make weird, distinct sounds, nobody really showed up. According to an eyewitness there, there was about seven people. There was seven people, and the band was bigger than the crowd that they had. And to make matters worse, you also had guys tripping all over things because they were running so many cables for all the instruments. It was poorly reviewed, it was a total disaster, but that is not allegedly what broke up ELO for the first time. It was actually Sharon Osbourne's father, Don Arden. A lot of rock fans will know that name. This dude was a hardcore manager in the Wild West days of rock and roll. And by wild, I mean hang a rival record executive out of a four-story window 40 years before Suge Knight did it. Roy Wood, who was one of the founding members, had dealt with Don Arden before, wanted no part of it. There were so many clashes that, boom, ELO breaks up, half the members leave, they go to form Wizard, but the remaining ones, led by new singer Jeff Lynne, who'd been bumped up to that spot, decided to soldier on. And it was probably a good thing that they did, because ELO got kind of big. 15 top 20 singles, 27 top 40 singles, and they hold the record for the most Billboard Hot 100 top 40 hits without a number one single of any band in chart history. But as we've been taught time and time again, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. From seven people to selling out stadiums, we're looking at ELO today,
as it was originally intended on their very first album, just called The Electric Light Orchestra. Hit them with a little 10538 overture. With that, we've hit the end of another Liner Note Leftovers. It feels like it just begun, but now we're at the end. But time flies when you're talking about drugs, Sesame Street lore, and the origins of ELO. Drop by again next week. We'll get into five more stories from the history of rock and roll, life's liner notes, and all that good stuff. This is your master crate digger, Dan Soul, signing off for another day. And remember, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to myloydminsternow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.